Hello, everyone. I'm really happy to be here with you. I want to thank Jim for asking me to speak and introduce myself. And thanks to all of you for this really warm welcome over the last 6 months. And forgive the meanderings, because the way-seeking path is never a straight line. And I think I came into the world seeking the way. When I was a child, I can remember feeling the spirits in the trees and hearing the stars sing, and intuitively knowing that this great web of being was part of me and I part of it. And I called that shimmering oneness God, because that was the language of my family. I am the eldest child of a Christian theologian and the grandchild of four Presbyterian missionaries. Luckily for me, the God of my childhood was a loving, inclusive, and justice-making God. I was born in 1960, so I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, very much aware of the social upheaval in the wider world and the role of progressive religious leaders in addressing the hurting world. MLK was my childhood hero, and I was confirmed into a United Church of Christ congregation led by the anti-war activist, the Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Jr. It was an interracial social gospel church, so I got what I consider to be the best of the Christian experience. But the older I got, the less I could buy the whole Father, Son, and Holy Ghost business. But I never stopped believing that love and justice are essentially the same thing, and what people who use God language mean when they say God. In my teens, I became a feminist, and soon after starting college in the late 70s, I came out as a lesbian. This made Christianity incompatible with my life at that time, and so I left the church altogether. But I missed the spiritual community that I had grown up with, a community that combined religious and social justice commitments. So I went looking for other feminists who were equally committed to spiritual seeking and to activism. And I discovered a women's spirituality movement that celebrated the divine feminine and found joy in the body, in the turning of the seasons, and the play of earth, air, fire, and water. As my childhood mysticism might suggest, earth-based spirituality was something I had a natural affinity for, and it's still part of my life today. I was also really intrigued by Buddhism. As a teenager, I was a voracious reader, and I came across Hermann Hesse's novel Siddhartha, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I read all the existentialists and transcendentalists who'd been influenced by Buddhism, and it piqued my curiosity. Then, as a college student, I had the opportunity to sit in on a lecture by Jan Willis, the African-American scholar of Buddhism, who's herself a practitioner in the Tibetan tradition and who was just starting out in her academic career. And I remember sitting in the lecture hall as she was giving sort of an overview of Buddhism and wanting to leap out of my seat and shout, yes, you know, that's it. Her description of basic Buddha Dharma, the basic teachings of the Buddha, struck me as incontrovertibly true in a way that Christian doctrine never had. I dropped out of college. I spent the 80s deeply engaged in activism around peace and justice issues, ranging from nuclear disarmament to feminism, lesbian and gay rights, and the AIDS epidemic. And the anti-nuclear work in particular brought me and my ragtag band of pagan Amazon warriors into a coalition with a diverse bunch of activists, which included Quakers, Unitarian Universalists, and the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And I have a distinct memory of being in jail after civil disobedience on Mother's Day, 1982. There were about 100 women being held together in a day room. And one day, while in custody, all of us got involved in this big debate about the relationship between anger and nonviolence. All of us were committed to nonviolence. That was part of what we had done together. But we had very different ideas about how anger related. And I was of the view, as were many of my sisters, that it was really important for women in particular to express our anger, give it voice, and use it as energy to fuel our nonviolent direct action work. But others thought that expressing anger at all is a form of violence. And ironically, the debate got very heated. And I don't remember what any of the women from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship actually said, but what made an impression on me is that they weren't staking out opinions the way the rest of us were and trying to convince anybody of anything. They seemed comfortable with paradox and nuance while all the rest of us were digging into our positions. And that made an impression on me. So over the course of my 20s, I read more and more widely across the entire range of Buddhist traditions without ever choosing a place to land and call home. I sometimes visited practice centers, insight meditation, Theravada, Tibetan, never Zen, which I'll come back to, but I remained a solo practitioner, which is ironic because in my personal and political lives, which I profoundly believed had to be interrelated, I was all about intentional community, right? And I found the Buddhist teachings about Sangha to be really moving and inspiring. But the fact was, in the 1980s and even in the 1990s, my impression of the Buddhist communities I visited was that they were almost entirely white, predominantly male, and almost exclusively straight. And that wasn't my scene. So I did my Buddhist practice on my own and found community elsewhere. There was another very big obstacle to my early Buddhist practice. It is difficult, if not impossible, to maintain a regular meditation practice while drinking alcoholically and abusing drugs. And I was doing both. I had been drinking and using since my earliest teens in a way that became life-threatening at a very young age. And just as much as my young adulthood was shaped on the one hand by my social justice commitments and spiritual seeking, it was equally shaped by substance abuse and a legacy of family trauma I was trying to escape through alcohol and drugs. I had a genuine aspiration to awaken and a compulsive need to self-obliterate. And that is not non-self. That is anti-life, right? So those two things were on a collision course with each other. And that collision finally landed me in 12-step recovery as a young woman, where there was a lot of God talk in the meetings that I found completely alienating. But luckily, I already had a basic Buddhist vocabulary and an ability to translate. So when they said, for example, "let go and let God," I said to myself, "practice non-attachment." They said higher power, I said Buddha nature, and the longer I stuck around, the more I discovered core commonality between the principles of 12-step recovery and the principles of Buddhist practice as I understood them. So Buddhism actually gave me a way to navigate my recovery program, and sobriety gave me the ability to finally do what Buddhism had been trying to teach me, which is to be present for my actual experience, which I could not do until I got sober. And so the two paths became united for me, and they still are. So you don't need my whole biography. I got sober, I stayed sober, went back to school, entered my 30s, went to law school, and continued to meditate on my own. Sometimes I'd visit Spirit Rock. It was great to be there when Thich Nhat Hanh was there. But I remained a very deliberately unaffiliated Buddhist. And then later in my 30s, when I was setting out to start a family, I felt like I had to find an intergenerational inclusive spiritual community, because I wanted my kids to have what I had had as a child, a place where spiritual development and social justice commitments were integrated. And that's when I found Unitarian Universalism, which was a perfect fit for me. UUs, for those who aren't familiar with that faith tradition, come together based on shared commitments to love, justice, and interdependence, without any dogma or creed. All the great wisdom traditions, including Buddhism, are honored, and everyone is encouraged to find practices that work for them. So for about 20 years, I described myself religiously as a Unitarian Universalist whose practices and worldview were Buddhist. Now, I say, borrowing words directly from my teacher, I am 100% Buddhist and 100% Unitarian Universalist. That's another talk. I've given it at my UU congregation. Anyway, as a UU, I got to go on my first silent retreats of any length. We did mindfulness meditation, we did walking meditation in the Thich Nhat Hanh style, and I did my own practices like chanting the green Tara mantra from the Tibetan tradition while I walked labyrinths, and I developed my own devotional relationship to Kuan Yin based on visualization practices that I mostly came up with on my own, frankly. And I did a lot of metta. Sometimes I followed traditional metta instructions, and sometimes here too, I developed practices of my own, one of which I want to share with you because it was so important in my personal development. And it relates to the work that I did for a long time representing death row inmates as a lawyer. I loved that work, and I formed profoundly meaningful relationships with my clients, who were human beings and not monsters. A big part of capital defense work is what we call social history investigation, which means working with investigators, social workers, mental health experts, and others to develop a comprehensive history of the client, their family, their community, what I, as a Buddhist, would call their karmic crucible. As a lawyer, we called it mitigation evidence. And it meant delving into the histories of trauma that shaped my clients and turned them into people who committed capital crimes. It was generational trauma and abuse in every case, invariably. And of course, my clients also caused unspeakable trauma. And having to immerse oneself as a professional in the traumatic material of other people's lives can be really harmful. There's a phenomenon called secondary trauma that's experienced by people who do capital defense work. Psychotherapists can often suffer from it, so can emergency room physicians and certain other professionals who deal with traumatic material all the time. Marinating in atrocity is not healthy, physically or mentally. People burn out. They get hardened or they get jaded. And what I observed in my colleagues is that some of them lost the ability to have compassion for their clients. And some of them were so zealous about maintaining compassion for their clients, because everybody else in the world hates them and thinks they're subhuman, so committed to compassion for the clients that they had no room for compassion for the victims. And I didn't want my heart to be damaged in any of those ways. So this was the practice that I developed. Every time I went out to San Quentin to meet with a client, which I did very regularly, I would stop first at the little beach just outside the perimeter of the prison. And I'd go down to the water and stand in Tadasana, that's mountain pose in yoga, and follow my breath for a bit. And then I would send loving kindness to my client as he was then, and then to my client as he was at the time he committed the capital murder, which might have been 20 years before, and then to him as he was as a small child, an abused child, and then as he was as a newborn infant. And I would send loving kindness to his family members, those who loved him, those who abused him, and those who had loved and those who had abused those family members, right? And out in the familiar concentric circles, I asked that all of them be safe, protected, and free from suffering, healed, whole, and happy. And then I would extend that same metta to the guards at the prison. I was not their favorite person. We were not their favorite people. That was mutual. But I would send them metta. And to all the players in the criminal justice system, especially those who had wronged my client, because there were dirty prosecutors and incompetent defense lawyers and jurors who committed misconduct. And then I sent loving kindness to my client's victims and to their loved ones and to everyone affected by that loss and that trauma. And I sent them love. I sent them wishes for healing, protection, wholeness, and happiness. And only when I had done all of that in a way that felt complete would I go visit my client. I think it helped me and it helped my clients. I hope it helped everyone to whom I was sending loving kindness. All right, so fast forward another decade or so. I finally come to Zen in my late 50s, only 6 years ago. And it was through the Dharma gate of a new relationship. Very long story, very short. I fell in love with her, then I fell in love with Zen. Here I am. And I tell you, it was the liturgy that did it. The first time I participated in a Zen service and experienced the chanting and the prostrations as we did just a little while ago, it was like my whole body was a bell that was ringing. And, you know, I love ritual, pagan ritual, UU ritual, my own self-created ritual, ritual that is heartfelt and authentic and that really makes the invisible visible and expresses the ineffable through the body, which Zen rituals do. It was just on my frequency. I mentioned before that when I had been exploring Buddhist communities and rejecting all of them earlier in my life, I never visited a Zen center. I've only recently asked myself why. And I think that I had written off Zen without ever checking it out because I had assumed the truth of certain stereotypes, and also because I had absorbed the stories of a beloved friend who'd had a very negative experience as a 19-year-old resident in an American Zen center, not one of the San Francisco Zen centers, but it could have been, right? So without any personal experience at all, I thought I knew that Zen was cold, rigid, hierarchical, and patriarchal, which is not what I have found. The Zen I have experienced has been warm and inclusive, full of poetry and beauty and invitation to connection. And the forms don't feel rigid to me. They feel like invitations for my body to lovingly hold and express the blooming of my heart and mind, right? Blanche Hartman talked about allowing the life force to bloom. And I think she was quoting Katagiri, but that's what I find in our forms and in the very precision of it, right, rather than rigidity. Anyway, that internal bell that I felt at the first service just kept ringing, and I couldn't deny that I already knew in my bones that Zen was my place and my path. And that meant I had to find a teacher and a sangha separate from my partner. She's a priest and a Dharma-transmitted teacher. She leads her own sangha comprised of her students, and it wasn't appropriate for me to make my home there. And my confusion about what to do and where to go coincided with the COVID lockdown of March 2020, when all the Zen communities, like everything else in the world, had to pivot to an online format, whether they'd ever had one before or not. And it became possible for me to practice with a monastery in Oregon. and Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico, which I knew because of its work around socially engaged Buddhism, which had such great appeal to me. And that is when I connected with the Meditation in Recovery affinity group from San Francisco Zen Center, which brings together 12-step recovery and the principles of Zen practice in that way I talked about and integrates them. So I've been practicing with them as one of my primary sanghas ever since. And I'm now part of a number of small groups that meet online, both some convened by my teacher and some affiliated with Upaya. And until 6 months ago, my in-person practice was limited to special opportunities and occasions. You know, one day sits at Green Gulch, either with meditation and recovery or with everyday Zen, an occasional opportunity for a retreat or special services, special ceremonies. And now I'm here with you. It's a patchwork for me, my Sangha life. And before I say more about that, I want to tell you how I found my teacher, because it's an important part of this journey. I had heard of Zenshin Florence Kaplow, both because I knew her book that Jim had mentioned, The Hidden Lamp, and also because I knew through the Zen grapevine that she was a Unitarian Universalist minister, as well as an ordained Zen priest, and having that in common felt like it might be significant. She's part of the Suzuki Roshi lineage, and I knew that this was where I wanted to make a home, but I met her when she was part of the faculty, if you will, for a practice period that I was participating in online with Upaya. And the theme of the practice period was liturgy. So I was all excited, the bell was ringing, and there was Zenshin available for practice discussions, so I signed up. And as soon as we had that first conversation, I knew that I would ask her to be my teacher, and she has been ever since. I also knew from the beginning, from feeling that vibration, that I was going to want to take the precepts formally, right? I know a lot of people who I consider very devoted lay practitioners who have never wanted to participate. For anybody who's new, Jukai is kind of like an initiation ceremony where you formally receive the precepts, which are commitments to live one's life according to the bodhisattva path and certain ethical guidelines. You can go forever and not do that, but I knew I wanted to. It felt important to me in ways I don't even have words for or a rational explanation. But when I went to Zenshin, it was to ask her to teach me and guide me and give me the precepts. My free-range Buddhism days were firmly behind me. I think that much is clear. And I've recently had cause to reflect again on how profound the process of preparing for Jukai was for me. This time last year, I had just finished my rakusu. You sew one of these babies, which is Buddha's robe, as part of the preparation, and then your teacher presents it to you in the ceremony. I finished sewing it last May at Tassajara, and the sewing practice itself, some of you know because you've done it, was a very profound experience, and I feel the reverberations of it every time I put the rakusu on. I've had the opportunity in the last month to give a couple of practice talks to different sanghas about taking refuge. And I've had this vivid somatic memory of stitching and sinking the stitch with my breath and sinking the stitch and the breath with the chant, Namu Kiye Butsu, I take refuge in Buddha, and sewing my vow into my rakusu, into my body, to my life, right? Down and through and up and back and down and through and up like a wave or like a bow. And it was a really beautiful thing, and I still feel it. The ceremony itself was a really beautiful thing. It was last summer in San Francisco. And I have to say, given the things that have happened since last summer, namely an election, some developments nationally, I am really grateful to have received the precepts and committed myself to them and formally, publicly taken vows to live the life of a bodhisattva, because I need those vows to get through this. I use them like a staff. And that's not, you know, I didn't come up with that. I'm sure you've all heard it before. Cynthia, my partner, quotes her teacher, the late Darlene Cohen, as saying, your vow is your staff. And I use it to keep from falling down. And when I fall down anyway, I use it to get back up. The ground feels really shaky right now in the world. The world and the country are in a state of polycrisis. There are environmental and climate crises. There's a crisis of democracy. There are wars and genocide. And like you, I feel it. I'm also experiencing polycrises in my family life. You know, the truth of suffering cannot be avoided. It just manifests itself differently in different times and places. But right now, I'm dealing with a brain-damaged and psychiatrically disabled brother whose care I'm responsible for coordinating and who has high medical needs that are a burden. It's a burden I bear willingly, but it's a lot. And I have a 27-year-old son with untreated mental illness who's on the verge of homelessness. So it's really heartbreaking. And when I feel this overwhelmed and this heartbroken, I have to use my vow as a staff. I have to practice as if my head's on fire, like Dogen said. And when I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, whether it's here on Thursday mornings or when I'm chanting at home, I am giving myself as completely as I know how to Buddha, to Dharma, to Sangha, and asking them to take refuge in me and be expressed through me. When I was at Tassajara the week before some of you, with Cynthia's group. And when I'm there, I like to walk in the creek, not along the creek, in the creek. I hike from the student housing to the just above the narrows, down the creek, which requires a stick. So I had my hiking pole. And I made it my practice to focus on the physical sensation. Well, I had to. It's not like it was a choice. I would have fallen over. I was focusing on the sensation of maintaining balance, losing balance, regaining balance in response to changing water velocity and turbulence and depth and different rocks. And I was experiencing the relationship between my body and my stick and that dynamic exchange in the balance finding process and the relationship between that dynamism and all those other forces. And I thought, yeah, living in these times, leaning on my vow is like this. The creek's got some really good Dharma teachings. Anyway, I want to conclude by telling you what an important part of my Sangha patchwork you all have become. Back in those days when in-person practice was a rare treat, I would go to Zenshin for Dokusan and say, oh, it was so great being in a room with other people and really having that somatic resonance. You know, it's too bad I can't have that in Sacramento. And I knew you were here. It's not like I didn't know Valley Streams existed, but I thought, this does not work in my life. Meditation and recovery meets on Monday nights. And that's an important commitment of mine, right? And Thursday morning, it's really early, you know? And it's one thing when I'm staying at Green Gulch or Tassajara. I can follow a schedule. I've done plenty of monastic visits. I like that. But during my work week? Anyway, Zenshin finally lovingly pointed out to me that actually I had an opportunity for in-person Sangha and that I was choosing not to avail myself of it, and I needed to either own that or change it. So I decided, as an experiment for the month of November of 2024, I would come on Thursday mornings and see how that went. And it was great. You guys are great. So I kept coming back. And then I realized, you know, meditation and recovery meets every Monday and every Friday, and no one is really there every single time. I can alternate my Monday nights in order to form a relationship here. So I've done that, and I appreciate the welcome. And I believe that concludes my talk. With great gratitude, I hope that I am able, through my presence with you, just sitting on the cushion and chanting along, that I can support your practice with my presence the way you support mine. Thank you very much for your kind attention. And yeah, and if anybody, you know, has questions or comments, I'm happy. Yes. Is there a mic?
Oh, yeah.
So that the Zoom folks can hear?
So it sounds like your practice with Zenshin is online, is that correct?
Primarily, yeah. Mm-hmm. She recently relocated from the Midwest to the Pacific Northwest, which is her home place. I go visit her, mm-hmm. you know, at least once a year, and she comes to the Bay Area at least once a year, so we meet in person when we can.
Cool.
But our regular meetings are online.
I'm curious, how often you guys meet for Dokusan, and you know, as much as you feel comfortable talking, like, what's the nature of
sure.
your practice? Is it open-ended and informal, or is there some sort of structured practice? I'm curious what the nature of your practice
you.
Is with her.
We meet, the formal commitment is to an hour-long meeting every month. She doesn't meet with all of her students for an hour, but that is what works for us. The normal format of our meeting is that we sit together for 20 minutes, and then we have a 15-minute, maybe, practice check-in and discussion. And then we also have some study. You know, obviously, when I was preparing for Jukai, it was usually a study session or a mixed study session and practice discussion. And Zenshin was... It was a slow process. I spent at least 1 month on each of the 16 precepts, reading and writing and talking with her, sometimes more when there was something really meaty there that I was working with in my life. So that was a couple of years of study. Since Jukai, we have been reading together Kazan's Transmission of Light in the Thomas Cleary translation, which is so beautiful. And that's a much looser kind of thing. I'll read a few chapters and email her a couple days before Dokusan to say, this is how far I've gotten, and then we pick one to read aloud together and discuss. But there are times when my practice with my life is such that I begin after meditation by saying, let's put Kazan to the side. I really need to talk about what's going on with my son. I really need to talk about what's happening on the cushion. I really need to talk about the way my mind went completely crazy in Sesshin in response to something in one of the Dharma talks, right?
Thank you. One more quick question,
yeah.
If it's okay. You mentioned in your first meeting with her, you knew you wanted her to be.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm sure there was a lot of it. That was ineffable about that, but yeah. I was wondering if there's any characteristics or attributes of her that you can remember that made you realize she was your teacher.
You know, I just got lucky. I felt an intuitive affinity. And some of it was her understanding about being Buddhist in UU and actually having a lot more experience having that joint identity than I did, right? She's also an ecologist. She had a career in environmental science and a commitment to the Dharma of the green world. I had read a lot of her writings about that, and they had really, really moved me. But when I told her about my body being a bell, she immediately got it and quoted me this really great poem. So,
Thank you.
Yeah, that was it. Yes, let's hear a question on Zoom. Hi, Jody.
Hi. Hi, Alice. Oh, I'm not muted. Oops. I thought I was. Thank you very much for your Dharma talk. It was very beautiful and very moving. And a lot of things you said really resonated with me. I do want to say, as someone who is pretty regular at the Thursday morning, that I do really appreciate your presence there. And I have noticed what a solid, you know, sitter that you are. And when you're not there, I always wonder, oh, what happened to Allison? So you are missed as well. You're not there. A lot of what you said about, you know, the resonance in the body and how that translates into, you know, our practice and stuff. I just really appreciate that expression, and it kind of syncs with some of my experiences as well. I had a question when you were doing the metta practice for your clients and the extending circles of people. One of the things that is in a lot of metta practice is also to extend that to oneself. And I didn't hear you say that you also did that. So I was just curious about that.
I did include myself. And if I didn't say so, that was an error. It was in the written talk. Definitely for myself. And as I practice currently with other life challenges, particularly family challenges, I have found it to be really important to include myself in my metta practice, and also to do something that I don't remember receiving this instruction anywhere. It just sort of came to me that it would be very healing for me to extend loving kindness to myself at different points in my life, kind of like I described extending to my clients, my death row clients, at different ages. When I'm really deep in maternal guilt about my son's situation, or having a lot of anguish about family dynamics, or regret about things that happened the way they happened, I go back and extend metta to myself then, right? The 20-year-old drug addict Allison, you know, the Allison who was trying to get pregnant as a single woman and had fertility problems and thought it would never happen, you know, whatever. Allison who has been unskillful sometimes. Allison who has not known what to do sometimes. As well as Allison as she sits here right now. I recommend that.
I think you started coming here on Thursdays when it was cold and dark. And I remember being out there with the Han thinking how cold and dark it was out here. But then, oh, Allison's coming. So I could see your car pull up. So I'm glad you've started coming, and you chant really well to blow us away. I didn't really have any question other than, were you wearing shoes when you were going down the creek at Tassajara?
Yes, I was. Good. I was wearing my Tevas. Absolutely.
We had to cross the creek a few times, and I thought, and maybe one of us even used your stick. I don't know. Somebody had left some poles by the side of the creek, so
I've still got mine.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you for your talk.
Well, thank you so much. I was really moved by your story, and mostly not all. I mean, there's a lot of particulars that are transmitted in giving a way-seeking mind talk, but everybody has different particulars, but yeah. The main thing that really reached me is your total commitment. And commitment to whatever it is, I guess, you were doing, really shine forth, you know, how being intentional about your life is not something that I'm able to, in the way that you do it. But I appreciate it so much. And as another Thursday Sangha person, I just want you to know I appreciate your being with us. And the other thing we have in common is the resonance of our service and our chanting. And I'll share with you that a couple of days ago at Tassajara, when I tried to sit at the optional sitting period at 5 p.m., there was some Doan Rio training going on, and I just couldn't sit through it. So as I was departing, I told the Doan, I said, I understand completely. I'm part of the Doan Rio at our home Sangha. I understand. And he says, oh, well, would you like to strike the big bell? I don't know if you got a chance.
Not at Tassajara, but I've gotten to strike the big bell at Green Gulch.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's really, really, really great. Yeah.
So
good. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. A lot of what you said I can personally relate to. Not all, but a number of aspects. And I would like maybe just to touch base with you on it all at some point.
You are most welcome to do so.
Allison, I'd like to thank you very much for your buoyancy and commitment to practice. I think it's going to have a very healthy influence on us all. Thank you so much.
If I'm able to ask a question.
Please.
Thank you.
There we go.
Thank you so much, Allison, for sharing. And this is my first time being here, so
welcome.
Thank you. I'm here in deep reverence and support of my sister right now, who's also here, Kelly. And she is experiencing quite a bit of, quite a lot of things, but social anxiety, and asked me to speak on her behalf. She's in a really deep place of recovery after a relapse, and she really resonated with a lot of what you shared. And she wants me to ask the question, why is my family still here and loving me?
Why is my family still here and loving me?
Yes.
Because you are lovable. And because we're all part of one another, and they know that. And they can know it for you until you can know it. Yeah. I would encourage your sister to, or anybody else who's dealing with any kind of, not just substance use disorder, but any kind of compulsive behavior, or anybody who's affected by anybody else's substance use or compulsive behavior, to check out the schedule of meetings for meditation and recovery, which is a link you can find on the San Francisco Zen Center website. Any Monday night. The link actually also will work on Friday nights. but it's a pan recovery program. So it's open to anybody who's in any 12-step program or any non-12-step recovery program, or who's just recovery curious, and who's interested in a Buddhist perspective on the whole thing. Also, because you mentioned social anxiety, I just want to suggest as a resource that there is a recurring course, as well as I think an ongoing support group through San Francisco Zen Center, Transforming Anxiety and Depression, led by Dharma teacher Lisa Beth Hoffman, who's wonderful. So there are resources, both anxiety-related and recovery-related, available through the Zen Center that can all be found online.
Thank you so much.